This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents American Girl, a novel written by Wendy Walker, performed by Paige Lael with a full cast. Please be advised that this production contains strong language, distressing situations, and realistically depicted gun violence that some listeners may find upsetting. Discretion is advised.
Prologue. Rule number 3. People are predictable. Which is how I know everyone will be asleep when I get home. I take a shower and wash away the smell of the grease from the grill and the juice from the pickles. I wash my hair and put in conditioner and wait exactly 2 minutes, like it says on the bottle, counting the seconds in my head. I rinse it out. I reach for the faucet, but then suddenly I stop. Soap, shampoo, conditioner for 2 minutes, water off, reach for the towel, which is on the rack, dry body, wrap hair, put on pajamas. I remember all of the things that come next, but I stand still, the water pounding the top of my head, because something isn't right. It's the bleach. The smell of the bleach that I can't wash clean, and this smell has derailed my train of thought. My heart takes over now, and not in the emotional way, but in the holy shit, what do I do now way, in the pounding faster and faster way, in the blood rushing through my veins and then up to my head where it heats up and makes me turn and press my palms against the wall so I don't fall over way. I am not equipped for any of this, for what's happened tonight, for what will happen tomorrow. I am just a girl with a set of stupid rules. There's a soft knock on the door. And then my mom's voice. It comes in an irritated whisper, which is the only way she can yell at me without waking up Dusty and their boys. My mom was sleeping too when I got home. She would have whispered her yelled at me sooner if she'd been awake and heard me coming up the stairs. Charlie! I turn off the shower, but don't answer. The cold grabs me in seconds as the drops of water on my skin thermoregulate the temperature of the air. Charlie! The whisper is louder now. I can't find my breath to speak. I grab the towel and wrap it around my body, which isn't the right order of things, but I do it anyway. Then I open the door. My mom steps back and crosses her arms and looks at me, the irritation now sweeping across her face. I know every single one of her expressions.
What are you doing? It's 4 in the morning.
I start to shiver, and her face softens, and she sighs, which means her irritation is turning into worry. She steps inside the steamy room and closes the door behind her.
Here,
she says. And then she finds my pajamas and unfolds them and hands me the pieces one at a time, all with her back turned. She does not touch me or look at me while I'm naked, because the last thing she wants at 4 in the morning is for me to be upset. She wants me to get into bed and go to sleep so she can go back to sleep because she's always tired from something. My mom says she would sleep for a year if God would let her. When my pajamas are on and my hair is wrapped in the towel, I tell her I'm fine, and she leans her face in close until my eyes meet her eyes so she can tell if I'm lying. I avoid seeing her thoughts by counting her eyelashes. It's a trick I discovered when I was 13. She makes her decision, then backs away.
Okay, now go to bed.
I promise I will, and I do. I walk back to my room and brush my hair and get into my bed. Under the covers, I shiver again until I stop. And then I wait for the news to break and the text to come, which they do a few hours later. There are no dreams and no memories of waking. And my body remains in the exact same position. But the time passes quickly, so I know I slept for some of it. The first text comes at 7:30. It's from Nora, the manager of the Triple S. The others follow within seconds as the big news spreads across our small town. News that will be inside the walls of this house any second, too. News I brought with me when I walked through the back door, smelling of sandwiches and bleach. And fear. One after another, they come. And I read them, but don't reply. I know what to say, what to write. But I can't make my fingers move. Not yet. All I can do in this last moment before my mom is back with a louder knock and a real yell is read about how a man is dead. Not just any man, but the most important man in our whole entire town. And then try to predict what each and every person in my life will do next. Which is hard because all rules fail under certain circumstances. Some people call those caveats. It sounds better than the word failure, but failure is what really happens when a rule doesn't hold true. Rule number 3, caveat 1. People are predictable until someone gets killed. Chapter 1. 12 years earlier. I was 5 when my mom lifted me from my bed and into her arms. Before I was even fully awake, she whispered in my ear, "We're getting out of this place." The fighting must have gone on for a while by then, because they had gotten to the part when one person has stopped yelling and is running away. My mom carried me as she ran out of the house where I was born and where she was born, the only home either of us had ever had. I wrapped my arms around her neck and my legs around her waist as tight as I could so I wouldn't fall. She was running fast. Over her shoulder, I saw my grandmother storm after us, and then my grandfather behind her. They were both in their pajamas, and my grandmother's curlers were loose and uneven. This was how I knew it was the middle of the night, and that the fight had woken them. My mom had to put me down at the curb to open the car door, and when she did, my grandmother caught up. She grabbed my shoulders and turned me to face my mom. It was then that I saw she was wearing her going-out clothes and her going-out makeup, which meant the fight must have been about her going out after her shift at the diner. She'd been crying, so the makeup was running down her cheeks like railroad tracks, one on each side of her face. My grandmother let go, and I fell forward into my mom.
"Go ahead and take her," she screamed. "You'll never be able to raise a child like that. No way in hell."
When screaming was not enough, she spoke with her words broken up, like each one was its own sentence. This was one of the few things I would remember about her. My mom put me into the car and reached for the seatbelt, her black tears dripping on my head as she struggled to make it click. And she told me, "Close your ears, close your ears." So I put one hand over each of my ears and pressed hard. And then she shut the door and ran to the other side while my grandmother kept saying things. Even with my hands over my ears, I could still hear her because my mom hadn't said to close my eyes and I was watching my grandmother's wrinkled mouth through the window.
"She needs help."
When my mom didn't answer, my grandmother screamed out her name. "Eileen!" And then, after slamming her palms on the roof of the car and peering in my window, all the way through to the driver's seat where my mom was starting the ignition, she screamed to make sure we both heard her,
"Whores get what whores deserve!"
The car jerked forward, almost taking my grandmother off her feet, and I couldn't help but look back at her. My grandfather had stopped at the edge of the lawn, and the two of them stood there, in their pajamas, watching us drive away. When we turned the corner, my mom pulled over to find a cigarette in her purse. Before she lit it, she took my face in both of her hands.
"You forget everything, Granny said," she cried.
She lit the cigarette and blew the smoke out the window. The car was moving again, and I couldn't take my eyes off her face. I had never seen someone act like that before, and it felt important to remember it.
There's nothing wrong with you, Charlie. Do you hear me?
I didn't answer. My brain was busy sorting out the contradiction of her words, which said one thing, and the distinct look and sound of fear, which said something completely different. I had never been more confused about a person than I was that night.
You're perfect, and we're going to be fine. Wait and see.
She took another drag, blew the smoke, then gasped with a giant sob. She repeated those words as we drove around town, looking for a place to park for the night where the police wouldn't bother us, and I started to say them along with her, like we were singing a song together. We're going to be fine. We're going to be fine. We're going to be fine. This is when I made my first rule about people. Rule number one. If someone says the same thing over and over again, that means they don't believe it. Chapter 2. 4 years later, my mom finally explained what made me a child like that. It was Sunday, and on Sundays she took a long nap in the afternoon while I watched my shows in the kitchen. Sunday was a bad day for shows on cable, so I watched DVDs on the little silver machine she bought me for Christmas. The day had been strange. Strange in a way that made her seem happy. In a Burger King for dinner way, even though it was not in our budget. And in a humming songs to herself way. And in a laugh out loud for no reason way. It made me nervous when my mom got happy like that. It usually meant something bad for me. At 6:30, after her nap and after Burger King, she went to the bathroom to put on her eyelashes. Humming and perfume slipped beneath the door and into the room where I was alone on our unmade bed, having returned there as soon as we finished eating. I liked being in our bed. It smelled of her, and her smell was comforting. My mom taught me there was no point making a bed unless we had company coming. She taught me other things, too. Important things that I couldn't learn from my shows or from watching the kids at school. Like when someone asks me what I like, I should answer quickly, then ask what they like. Because people like to talk about themselves, and they don't really want to hear about me. And like when the teacher says to raise my hand if I know the answer, I shouldn't do it every single time because that's annoying. I was waiting for her to finish in the bathroom and kiss me on the forehead and tell me she'd be back before I knew it, and then grab her purse and the nice wool coat that hung in the closet by the door, and then turn out every light that I didn't need and say one last goodbye. But on this night, at 7 o'clock, after she'd put on her eyelashes and perfume, she'd come and sat on the bed with one leg tucked under her and one hanging off the side. She had a familiar smile on her face. It was a smile she had when she told me things I wouldn't like, but that I couldn't change. Things I wasn't allowed to be mad about. That's when the bad thing that I knew was coming finally came. "This is what's happening," she said. More words followed about how it might be hard for me because I've gotten used to these past 4 years with it just being the two of us, but there were things about the world that I didn't understand.
"Please try, Charlie. Try not to be too upset. Try to be a good girl about it."
I studied her face because being a good girl could mean different things in different situations. If she was sad, I should pinch my eyes together and tilt my head to one side. If she was happy, I should smile so big my teeth showed. I knew my mom very well. Like she said, it had always been just the two of us. But at this moment, I felt scared. I didn't know what she needed from me to stay happy. And I wanted her to stay happy. I wanted it more than anything. "I've been seeing Dusty for over a year and a half," she said. My mom counted time in all different increments, years, months, weeks, sometimes even in hours or minutes.
It's been 4 hours since I called Dusty. It's been 3 minutes since I texted Dusty. Why won't he call? Why won't he answer? I should have known Dusty was going to ruin things. Tonight, she counted in years, which meant she wanted it to seem like more time than it was. She went on about how she'd been dating Dusty for over a year and a half, and how that was long enough, and so they were getting married. But that wasn't all. She grabbed my hands in her hands and squeezed so hard my knuckles cracked. She was having his baby, she said. My mind spun in circles with what this meant for me. I was consumed by self-interest, from being 9, but also from something else about me, which I was about to learn. She was right that I was used to sharing the small apartment with her and sleeping in the same bed, and that I had liked it because I never worried about scary thoughts or bad dreams, except for the night she went out with Dusty, and I had to go to sleep before she came home. And the baby? I decided that was good because I liked babies. But then her words, "Try not to be too upset," snuck in and around all of my thoughts and squished them like Play-Doh, reshaping them into other thoughts. She worried that this news would upset me, which meant there was something upsetting about it. "Do you have any idea how lucky we are?" she asked me. Dusty was a lawyer at his own law firm. He was a good man, she said. The kind who went to church and sat on the town council. He was an important person in this town, but what mattered most was that he was going to marry her and make us his family. Dusty was 13 years older than my mom, 38 and still not married, so people were starting to talk. He was running out of options, she explained, and I pictured us like the last turkey at the grocery store the night before Thanksgiving. I also pictured his short, stubby body and double chin and wondered if it would be hard to look at him every day for the rest of my life. Then I told myself to keep that inside my head. That was not a nice thought to have, and I had been practicing at not letting those thoughts sneak out. Next came her grand finale. "And we can finally leave this shitty apartment." It was not the first time I'd heard that word, but it took on a new meaning when she used it to describe our home. Shit is a word that would stick in my head because it's used in more ways than any other word I would ever know. Like when something unexpected happens, shit, oh shit, holy shit. Or to describe someone, ape shit, full of shit, chicken shit, scared as shit, tough as shit, piece of shit, shit-faced, shithead, up shit's creek. Or to describe something bad, horse shit, dog shit, bullshit, a pile of, a load of, a world of, a crock of, a shit show, or just plain shitty. Then there's the caveat for when something is good, the shit. And you can even be in it, deep or up to your eyeballs, or just inside the place we put it, the shitter. There must be 100 more that I collected as I got older. But I'd never thought of our apartment as shitty. And I realized then that I had missed the signs that my mom did. Her eyes grew distant, like she was seeing a script she'd written play out before her. I watched her lips move as she rambled. "No, we wouldn't have to live here anymore with the roaches and the mice and the creepy old man down the hall. And she probably wouldn't even have to keep working at Dusty's office, because how would that look if the receptionist and the boss were married? It could have backfired, but it didn't. And now she'd gotten us out of this disaster by the skin of her teeth. The disaster that started when love stole her dreams. When she was done looking through me to her new perfect life with a house and a husband who was a lawyer and a new baby, her face grew reflective and serious. Her pupils narrowed inside the bright blue circles that surrounded them, and her focus returned to me and to this moment on our unmade bed in our shitty apartment. "Do you know how lucky we are?" she said a second time. I noticed then how she lifted just one eyebrow And because I knew her face better than I knew my own, I also knew that this meant I was supposed to imagine more words than the ones she was saying. In the next moment, a dam burst in my brain, and I was suddenly drowning in all of those unspoken words. About the other boyfriends who left her after they met me. About the endless conferences with my teachers at school. And, of course, my grandmother's words the night we escaped. A child like that. "You're old enough to understand," she said. She spoke to me then about being me. And I felt my eyes ache from opening too wide and for too long without blinking, because I could not afford to miss one change in her expression. For the first time in my life, she was describing things I already knew about myself that I thought no one else had noticed because I was so good at pretending. I watched my shows, studying every character and scene. I watched the kids and teachers at school, the people on the street and at the grocery store and in the mall and every place we ever went. And most of all, I studied my mom. I began to form rules like math equations. When this happens, people act that way and say those things. When that happens, people act this way and say other things. And those rules stayed in my head, each and every one. I realized I could use them to prepare for whatever was coming, to protect myself. My mom went on to tell me I was like a lopsided seesaw. And this image gave my feelings a home inside my head. A shelf to sit on, a box to live in. I didn't know the box had a name, and that the name was autism, until I was 11. It was a relief, but also a burden I would carry forever. Like if she told me my nose was too big or my eyes were set too close together, I would never again be able to think that I was the same as everyone else. I didn't like seesaws. But of course I had watched them and knew how they worked. They became lopsided when one side was heavier than the other. My seesaw, she explained, was uneven because I was very good at some things, like math and remembering, and not as good at other things, like talking to people and playing at recess and handling situations that other kids enjoyed, like noisy places and bright lights. And how, when that weaker side of my seesaw had too much to handle, it caused my entire head to get hot. Hothead. Lopsided seesaw. Hothead. Lopsided seesaw. These new words would stay with me like all the shit words, which is fitting since that was how it felt to know about them. Shitty. "You know that thing you do with your hands?" she asked me. And I was doing it then, the second she let go of them, tapping my thumbs with my forefingers, right and left together, right, then left. When she looked at my hands, I was tapping in a pattern, three together, then right, left, three together, then left, right. "It takes a lot of concentration to do that," my mom said. "It cools off your head." I stared at my fingers and thought about the times I tapped them. Or watched my shows, or found a place to be alone and scream into my elbow so no one would hear. She was right. It was always when I felt the heat coming. "And when you move your shoulders back and forth, you know, like a little dance, you do that when you're happy. Back and forth, like there's music playing, but there's no music anyone else can hear." This was also true. I did like to shimmy when I felt good. And when I was bored at school, I tried to cross my toes inside my shoes, which is very hard and can keep me occupied until I stop being bored. There were other things, too. Movements and motions for different feelings. I had never, ever thought about any of this before. Kids did all sorts of things, like chew their nails and twirl their hair and even pick their noses. And they said stupid stuff and made other kids cry or run to tell a teacher or start a fight. We were all just trying to figure out how to be in our own ways. Or that's what I'd always thought until my mom sat on our bed. "Mrs. Westerly explained it to me," my mom said. And I wondered when this happened and how long she'd known. Mrs. Westerly was my homeroom teacher. She thought she knew everything about all of us and said things like, "Sam, you're just angry because you didn't eat enough lunch," or, "Julie, you didn't do your homework because you're trying to get attention." I think about what she might have said to my mom. Suddenly, I saw the faces of all the men who asked her what I was doing with my hands or my shoulders, and why I never looked them in the eye, or why I stared at them too long. I thought they just didn't understand kids. But right then, I knew. We were lucky that I hadn't driven Dusty away, because whatever I thought about other kids and how I was just like them, I was wrong. I was a child like that. A child with a lopsided seesaw. I had made us the last turkey the night before Thanksgiving. Hothead, hothead. I stared at my fingers as they tapped faster. She leaned forward and kissed my cheek. Her lips were soft and sticky from gloss, and her eyelashes tickled my skin. She smelled nice, and I still thought she was beautiful, even though her words had set my head on fire. She got up and turned out the lights throughout our shitty apartment and grabbed her purse and pulled her nice wool coat from the closet and said she'd be back before I knew it. She left, locking the deadbolt from the outside. I let the upset come, and then I pushed it away by watching my show in our bed, and this cooled my head and kept me distracted for a few minutes. But my thoughts quickly wandered away from the show and sneaked back to the things I had just learned. There had been an urgency on my mom's face that told me my life would not be what I imagined it could be. She'd opened a door to a room I didn't know existed, a room where children don't belong. She'd opened it just a crack, enough to let me see the smallest piece of what was inside. Like 1 inch of a painting, the eye of Mona Lisa. Not the smile, the part that I needed to see to fully understand. So I knew that there was more. Much more. Her words and the knowledge of this room and what waited inside it would fight against my childhood. My naivete, my ignorance, and most of all, my lopsided seesaw. It would feel both disturbing and satisfying all at once, like I always sensed the place was out there, and now I knew for sure. I was 9, and I knew things that I shouldn't, about love killing your dreams and being the kind of person who would drive people away. And there were things that I could never unknow, like that night when we ran from the house where we both were born. When I was 5 and she was 21, when I was a child like that, and she was a whore. By the time that door swung all the way open 8 years later, and I saw everything that waited behind it, a man would be dead at my feet. Chapter 3. 8 years later. A man is dead. This thought arrives just as I get to work, but then come the words I always recite as I turn into the parking lot. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. The instant I stop, the thought returns. A man is dead. The Triple S opens at 10, so I get there at 9. It's Saturday, and I'm on the schedule for morning prep through closing, which is 9 a.m. to 10 p.m., a 13-hour shift. I beg for hours on the weekends when I don't have school. The Triple S is a sandwich shop here in Sawyer. Technically, it's called the Sawyer Sandwich Shop, but everyone calls it the Triple S, so now that's its name. It's even printed on our cups and bags. The owner, Clay Cooper, insisted on having quotation marks around the words, the Triple S. He said the quotation marks would avoid any problems because as long as something is in quotation marks, it can't be considered false advertising. Everyone calls him Coop, and Coop is the most important man in our town. He owns a lot of businesses and runs the town council. No one who's ever worked for Coop will be sad he's dead, and yet everyone will be sorry about it. That's what people call irony. I started working at the Triple S when I turned 14, which is the first year a person is allowed to work in Pennsylvania. I was about to start high school in the fall, but I was still young and Coop was the only person who would hire me. I needed to work for one reason, like anyone else. Money. I have a spreadsheet that keeps track of it. The first column has 5 entries: tuition, board, food, books, clothes. These are added together. The second column has 3 entries: federal loans, savings from my job, and the town scholarship, which I will win if I keep getting the highest grades. These are added together. The third column takes the difference and divides it by my net hourly wage and shows me the number of hours I still need to work before I can leave Sawyer for good. The number goes down every time I walk out the back door at the end of a shift. My mom was right. I became very good at math and got accepted to MIT, where I plan to study data analytics. That was the good news. The bad news was that I had to pay for it myself. Dusty made too much money for me to get financial aid, even though Dusty wasn't helping me pay for college. People call that a catch-22. I call it a shit sandwich. The point is, without Coop, I wouldn't have what I have. My third column wouldn't be going down, and I wouldn't be going to college. It's not easy to hate the person who's giving you the one thing you need most in the world. When I'm not at school or work, I'm usually with Keller, my best friend who also works at the Triple S. She has a boyfriend named Levi, who's a mechanic at the gas station across the parking lot. I was the one who got her the job here, and the one who covers for her when she's taking care of her sick grandmother. I'm the reason Keller met Levi. I'm the reason she met Coop, so I guess I'm also the reason for a lot of other things, but that's another story. Keller. Idealistic. Compassionate. Emotionally fragile. Vices. Smoking. Drinking. Being in love. My mom is the one who told me I needed to get out of Sawyer before I fell in love and had a baby. Love was like gravity, and it would grab hold of my ankles and never let go. If anyone would know about all that, it was my mom. If that ended up being true, Keller and Levi would be stuck here forever. Grades, scores, money. I've been doing everything I can to get out of Sawyer. And it has all been going as planned. Until today. Until Coop is found dead on the side of the road, just outside his own driveway, and right next to his own car. Janice is the first person I see when I walk through the back door. She works here full-time. Janice is in her 40s. I don't know exactly how old she is, because when someone's past 39, it's not polite to ask. I learned that from a movie my mom loves, where a younger man asks an older woman her age, and she slaps him clear across the face, and then tells him she's 39. My mom always laughs at that scene. However old she is, Janice and her husband Shane have 4 kids and a lot of bills to pay. Janice. Dependable. Devoted. Affectionate. Vices. Eating. Worrying. She's already prepping the tomatoes in the slicer, tossing them one at a time in front of the blades and slamming the handle against them until they're pushed through the other side, the slices falling into a rectangular metal pan. Her face is distant, and she's slamming the handle harder than I've ever seen her slam it. Except maybe on the day Coop fired Shane from the tobacco store, which he also owns. She's not paying attention either, which is very unlike her. Not pulling out the tomatoes that are too ripe for the slicer, so they explode when they hit the blades, spraying the bright red guts against the white wall behind the table where she works. She stops when she hears the door close. It's heavy and makes a loud bang. She wipes her hands on a green apron and pounces before I can hang up my coat. I wonder if I'll be able to look her in the eye today, but then I do. "Oh, Charlie," she says, and then she pulls me into a giant bear hug, which isn't easy for her because she's only 5 feet tall. I close my arms around her back and feel her rolls of flesh press against me. Her face nuzzles into my shoulder, and I let my cheek rest against the top of her head. I don't like to be touched without warning, so I always warn myself before I see Janice, because Janice always hugs me. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles. It's over before I can say onions.
This is all so horrible, Janice says after she lets me go.
I look beyond her to the tomato guts sliding down the wall, which ignites a sudden compulsion to clean. Janice's eyes follow.
Oh, jeepers.
She draws a hand to her mouth and sighs, her whole body limping with defeat. I've got it, I tell her, and I move quickly to hang up my coat on a hook by the door. There are two people there already, Janice and Nora, the manager. Nora's here? I ask, surprised. Saturday is usually her morning off, and I didn't notice her car in the parking lot. She's having a smoke. I take the hook at the far end, where it's less likely to be doubled up. There will be six of us here by noon. Me, Janice, Nora, and Keller make four, plus two other part-time workers. Keller calls them Lazy Tracy and Horny Helen. Tracy goes to my school, but he's a year younger. I can make twice as many sandwiches as he can in half the time. Helen is recently divorced, so she won't work the grill because it makes you smell like grease for the rest of the entire day, and she never knows when she might get a date after work from this app called FindLove.com. Is Nora okay? I ask Janice. Nora said she was quitting smoking 2 weeks ago. She's never lasted 2 weeks before. It can't be a coincidence that she's giving up the morning after Coop is found murdered. Janice makes a face that says she doesn't know. We both glance through to the dining room and the side door, which leads to a few outdoor tables, and I picture Nora sitting at one of them, smoking and thinking. Nora, honest, loyal, disciplined. Vices, smoking, being alone. Janice squeezes my hand. Let's just get to work, I say, trying to reassure her. Her worry feels infectious. I know a lot of things about people, and not just by observing them on TV and in everyday life and from the things my mom has told me. I've learned from research as well, online and in books. Everyone, it seems, has something to say about why people do what they do. Why they have bad habits and shitty marriages and can't make their kids listen. There are psychological patterns, casual relationships, personality traits, all of which help to make human behavior predictable. I've written down just about everything I've ever learned, because in spite of what my mother likes to say about my math skills and my memory, they are not that extraordinary. I'm not a robot. And these are the types of things I can't afford to forget, because they help me make predictions about the people around me. Today, I'll need this more than ever before. I grab a green apron from the pile on the back table where we keep things that need to stay clean from the prep. Aprons, purses, backpacks. I grab a towel to wipe up the spray from the tomatoes. The prep isn't messy if you do it efficiently. Every machine put to proper use, every surface covered with containers of meat, cheese, tomatoes, onions, iceberg lettuce. We shred the lettuce at the Triple S so it crinkles like confetti. This adds volume and texture and releases the sweetness that's trapped inside. The smell of produce and meat fills the air and mixes with the bleach from the cleaning, the preservatives in the cans of red peppers, and the vinegar from the salad dressing that's poured from buckets into the pans. The smell is distinct to this place, like the smell of my mom when we shared a bed. I don't notice it until I leave and then return. And when I do, it not only enters my nose, but reaches inside my body and tells it how to feel. For me, the smell of the Triple S is the smell of freedom. After a few months of working here, I built a model for Nora on her laptop, an Excel spreadsheet for the inventory. We track what is used for every lunch and every dinner, and the model allows us to make predictions. We know almost to the ounce what we need for each rush. I can think of only 4 times we were wrong and had to run back and stock something on the fly. Nora is tall and thin, and she smells of cigarettes, makeup, and hairspray. She dresses in nice clothes from the outlet stores, our town's main attraction, when the rest of us wear jeans and company t-shirts. Even in her dress clothes, if she's needed, she'll throw on an apron and start taking orders, jumping into the trenches in chaos as scraps of food fall onto her nice leather shoes. Nora is our fearless leader. At least, that's what I thought until today. The day Clay Cooper is found dead and nothing is the way it should be. Today, Janice is exploding the tomatoes, and Nora is smoking, and Keller has called in sick. The tomato guts slide from the wall to the floor as I wipe the cloth over them. A thought comes about blood. Bloody blood, blood. I close my eyes and shake my head, which is getting hot. Hot head, hot head. Janice is beside me, her hands squeezing my arms, her voice asking me, "Are you okay, Charlie?" The smell of cigarettes and hairspray fills my nose, and a new voice fills my ears. Nora is here now, asking the same question. "Are you okay?" And I realize that in all the years I've been studying everyone and anyone who might affect my life, I overlooked the most important person. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. A man is dead. His head bashed in. So much blood. No, no, no! I open my eyes and look at the wall, washed clean. Then I take a very deep breath. "We need 4 pans of lettuce," I tell them. Janice looks confused, but Nora understands because she knows the spreadsheets as well as I do. "That's right," she says, "because it's Saturday." I nod as I feel my head cool down. Then I repeat the words as I pull the list from my memory. 4 pans of lettuce because it's Saturday. Tracy and Helen come in at 11. By 11:30, the 5 of us are ready to take on the rush. Fresh green aprons tied neatly at the waist, thin plastic gloves over scrubbed hands, smiles glued on our faces. The store has 2 sections divided by a metal counter. On one side are the customers, the line where they order, the corner where they get their napkins and straws and throw away their garbage, the tables where they eat, and the bathrooms in the back. Behind the counter is a square work area. On one side is a giant grill. It looks like nothing, but if you put so much as a drop of water on it, it would come to life like a sleeping monster that just got a poke. Pans of freshly sliced meat and vegetables sit beside it with tongs and spatulas, all shiny and clean. There's a center island that holds the cold cuts and salads and more vegetables, like the shredded lettuce and the sliced tomatoes. There are wood carving boards on either side where we assemble each sandwich made to order. Each one different in some way, each one a new challenge. It's the same with the rush itself. Every day has its own rhythm, a slow trickle that catches up to us, a flash mob that comes from nowhere, a million combinations in between. I think of it like a new set of numbers needing to be sorted and solved. I can easily take 10 orders at once and not get one thing wrong. Not a meat, or a cheese, or a garnish, or a condiment. Sometimes it's shitty to remember some things without even wanting to, but not remembering other things. These orders will stay with me for days, but I'll have to study for hours to do well on next week's science test. How unfair is that? Nora stands beside me as the first 2 customers enter the building. There is a moment of hesitation as their hands first pull on the door. Will we be open today? Most of the customers know that Coop owns the Triple S. Not everyone has heard that he's dead. They see that we're open and come inside.
Country music blares from the speakers in the ceiling. Helen must have put it on. There's a Helen on every show I've ever seen. Dating apps, country music, inflated self-esteem. The music reminds me of characters like Helen, who are meant to annoy you, and then the words rhyme and repeat, and repeat, and repeat, and get stuck in my head, and I think that maybe I now hate country music as the customers approach the counter. Janice chooses to be at the grill, even though the smell of grease will cover every inch of her. But today, she says, she doesn't think she can do more than weigh meat and turn it with the spatulas. It's the job that requires the least amount of concentration. Janice doesn't want to slow us down out here while her thoughts are on Coop and on her worries that she can't shoo away. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. By noon, a long line has formed. I am focused, like I've never been focused before, taking orders, calling out to the line for new ones. Nora helps me from the other side of the island. Tracy tries to keep up at the register. Helen slices the bread faster and faster. By 1:30, the line is almost gone and the dining room is full, every seat taken. A few stragglers stare at the menu board that hangs above the metal counter, undecided, and we use the time to clean up. The counters and floor are covered with the ends of the bread loaves, a few pickles and onion slices, and of course shreds of lettuce, all the things that spilled out of the sandwiches as they were cut and wrapped. Janice takes a break to wash her arms and face in the back room, and, I imagine, to let the worry have its way with her. I can almost feel her thoughts floating out from the prep room, spinning through every possible scenario. Helen looks at men on her app. She glances at Nora, who shakes her head with feigned disapproval. Helen has tried to convert her, but Nora loved her husband, and he was killed in the army, and that's that. Still, she likes Helen and humors her when time allows. Like now, when the only customers left to serve are still deciding, and when it's good to not seem nervous about a man you wanted dead actually being dead. Nora turns from Helen to look at me. Her arm reaches out. Her hand rests on my back, firm and reassuring. She nods her head, and I nod back as if to say, I'm okay. But then we see the car pull into the parking lot. We see its red and blue lights and white paint and black letters that say Sawyer Police. I look back to Nora in time to watch her back straighten. She gasps in a deep breath, and then her eyes move from the car pulling into a spot labeled No Parking to a place in the dining room, a place way up high where the ceiling meets the wall. I follow her eyes with my eyes until I see what she sees. A small, black ball mounted just above a poster of a large triple S steak and cheese. A light flashes inside. A red light, just like the ones inside the small black balls they have in the hallways at school. In 3 years, I've never noticed it. I wonder how long it's been there. Then I think it doesn't really matter, because from the look on Nora's face, I know it was there last night. The night Clay Cooper was murdered, and I was captured on camera at the scene of the crime. Chapter 4. The cop's name is Ian McGuire, and he steals my breath. It's not just because I know why he's here. Ian steals my breath every day he walks through the door. Next to Keller, he's my best friend. Since third grade, they've let me take classes with a grade above, and so even though Ian is a year older than me and Keller, I knew him from math and science. He graduated last spring and joined the police force. He didn't even try to go to college. He says it's because he needs to help support his mother, who's a widow and works at the grocery store. That's part of the story. But I've done the math, and if Ian went to college, he could have a higher-paying job that didn't keep his mother up at night worrying. He qualified for the financial aid and merit scholarships, and didn't have a dusty in his way with a catch-22. Ian could have made it out of Sawyer. I've also done another analysis. Ian could have stayed in town and worked a less dangerous job at a local bank or selling insurance, for example.
Everything I know about people and everything I know about Ian tells me that he's a cop because no one ever solved the hit-and-run accident that killed his father 8 years ago. The driver is out there, walking around, living life, cruising in the orange Buick LeSabre that ran a man over. There's been no justice for Cullen McGuire, so Ian McGuire tries to balance the scale. Rule number 11. Emotions keep people from making rational decisions. I have loved Ian all this time. I loved him on the playground when we were in elementary school and raced each other on the monkey bars. I loved him when we were in middle school and had to build the solar system out of styrofoam balls and pipe cleaners. And I loved him in high school when he grew 6 feet tall and his eyes turned a deep shade of brown and I felt my insides stir, just like my mom told me they would. But that's another story. He steps to the side of the counter where customers collect their orders. "Hey, Charlie," he says when I walk to where he stands, the counter between us. "Hey, Ian." "Listen," he says. And that's when I know he's not here for his usual large steak and cheese with onions. "They have some questions about Clay Cooper. I can give you a ride." I study him, head to toe. The eyes that dart away just as his face struggles to display indifference. The shoulders that are lifted almost to his ears and the feet that shuffle side to side. He's making this seem like it's no big deal, but the things I've just described are signs of deception. I learned that from an excellent show about a lie detection expert who solves crimes. But even though I see all of this and know he's worried but trying not to show it, I smile and scrunch my eyes together with surprise, basically letting him off the hook. His deception is coming from a place of kindness, and that's a different thing altogether. "How long will it take? I have to prep for dinner." Now he shrugs and looks at the floor. "They didn't say." Nora comes to stand beside me, and I fill her in. She flinches, which is very uncharacteristic, and so it makes me flinch as well. "We can handle your shift. I'll call your mother," she says. "Don't answer questions until she gets there. They can't make you. Do you understand? You never have to speak. Never. And especially if you ask for a lawyer." Nora knows these things, and I nod in agreement. I tell Ian I'll meet him at his car, then I go to the back room. I take off my apron and place it in the dirty linen bin. Next, I wash my hands while Janice and Nora stand beside me discussing what this could be about, going through the scenarios, mapping out plans to help me. But a plan has already formed in my head. When I leave, I imagine there will be an awkward silence because between the three of us, I was the one who wanted him dead the least. I get my purse and my coat from the hooks and let Janice hug me while Nora finishes talking. "Remember," Nora says, taking my face in both of her hands, "no answering questions until your mother gets there." Ian is waiting in his police cruiser. I walk to the passenger side and reach for the door, but then catch his eye. He signals with a remorseful expression that I need to get in the back. So I retreat 2 steps and reach for the other handle. We don't talk on the drive because he's convinced Google and Zuck are always listening when his phone is with him. He even proved it to me once by speaking loudly about having back pain with his phone right next to us. Later that same day, he had 3 spam emails about products guaranteed to cure back pain. We laughed about it then. It happened before we stopped laughing together. I didn't need him to show me about the phone or the car. I always believe what Ian tells me. He's the kind of person you can do that with. And he's taught me about some very important things, like irony and sarcasm, and looking people in the eye when you talk to them, but not so much it creeps them out. And never, ever standing too close, because then you're a close talker, which is an actual thing that people don't like. Seinfeld, Season 5, Episode 18. The car smells of old leather and gasoline, and the lingering, stale odor of humans. men, women, old, young, drunk, scared, homeless, deranged, mad as hell, and pumped up on adrenaline. There are only so many reasons a person gets into the back of a police car. I imagine I'm adding to the aroma today. The smell of lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, and onions. We take the interstate because that's the fastest way. I have so many things I want to ask him, like, did they find out how Clay Cooper died? And what time did they think he died? And did they find anything on him that might be a clue as to who did this? But I keep my mouth closed tight. When we reach the top of the on-ramp, the billboards appear. We both look up at the same time and look away at the same time because we are both thinking the same thing, having the same memory from 1 year before we decided we couldn't be that way with each other. It was the worst night of my life. It happened under the billboard we call the Hand of God. It has a picture of an old man's hand with his scraggly finger pointed down toward us, the humans, and from the very tip is a bolt of lightning, but then a soft white cloud. The old man's hand is attached to an arm that's draped in a flowing white robe, but that's all we get to see. The arm, the robe, the hand and finger and cloud of light. The words on the billboard are in bright pink Gothic script letters. Repent and turn to God. All the billboards in the next row have the usual ads, pictures of steak, ads for tobacco, the exit for the water park. There is nothing special about the Hand of God, except that it is set back from the interstate, and in front of it is a row of thick evergreen bushes that are tall enough to cover the top of a pickup truck. If you line up just right, half a dozen cars and trucks can fit beneath the Hand of God and be hidden from the road. It's a popular place for kids to get lost for a while and do the things kids do when they get lost. Keller and I go there sometimes when she needs to get lost. Caring for her grandmother has become demanding. She quit school after 9th grade and now has 2 jobs working for Clay Cooper, one at the Triple S and one at the diner. Ian and I used to go there before we made our decision. It was the place he first kissed me. It was the place I first felt a hand on the small of my back, on my skin, soft and warm, like the light coming from God, literally right above us. It was the place where I tried to ignore the fear my mother had injected into me over the years. Ian sighs as we pass the billboards, and I close my eyes as tight as I can to stop what happens to my insides when I feel it. The stir.